Next up, we live today in the age of digital data. Your photos, your documents, even your thoughts are housed on thumb drives in the cloud, on your laptop, or your pad. Youngsters do not have shoeboxes full of old photos. Old phonograph records now sit in boxes in the attic or the basement. But in this digital age, we might also be in more danger of losing our data. I mean, we still have those photos. We still have those records. There's no physical record now of the digital stuff that you own. Your old CDs will not last more than a couple of decades. And this worries archivists and archaeologists and presents a challenge. Are our backups backed up themselves? Science Friday's digital team has been digging into those questions, and today they've unveiled their File Not Found series. It's a three-part series. It's actually a beautiful companion website all about the past, present, and future of data storage, and you can take a look at it and listen to it at sciencefriday.com/data. sciencefriday.com/data. Science Friday's web producer, Lauren Young, was the lead reporter on that package, and she's here now with us in our New York studios. Welcome back.
Hey, Ira.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
Now, the series, as I said, is very beautiful online.
Thanks.
Congratulations to you. Give us an idea what this data project is all about.
Sure. So today, a lot of our information, our memories, our lives really are saved as digital files, essentially data. So you may think that those photos on Facebook or all your tweets may last forever or maybe even come back to haunt you, depending on what you have out there. But I found out that, unfortunately, much of our digital information is at risk of disappearing in the future. And if that does happen, if our data really is lost, it could really put us in this realm called the digital dark ages. And when I was reporting the story, I talked to Rick Witt, who is at Google, and he manages the data preservation efforts there. And here's how he described it.
We may know less about the early 21st century than you do about the early 20th century, because the early 20th century is still largely based on things like paper and film formats that are still accessible to a large extent. Whereas much of what we're doing now, the things we're putting into the cloud, more of our digital content is now born digital. So it's not just something that we translated from an analog container into a digital container, but in fact is born and now increasingly dies as digital content without any kind of analog counterpart.
So going off of what Rick just said, so some experts that I spoke to have called the 21st century the time that we're living in right now as an informational black hole. So what that means is the digital information that we create right now may not be readable by like machines and programs of the future. So all that data, our eventual digital history, is at risk of being lost. And that's what we wanted to write about.
Yeah. Anybody got a floppy disk reader around anywhere? I understand exactly what you're saying.
Exactly.
And one of the stories in this series deals with something called the end of term web archive project, this sort of mad scramble, right? Tell us about that.
Right. Yeah. So at the end of every U.S. presidential term, so about every 4 years, the new administration can come in and change all of the content on government websites, the .gov domains, and there really isn't any law or regulation against this. So ever since around the Bush to Obama administration back in 2008, librarians and web archivists have been doing this big harvest of all the URLs of government websites. And it might sound like this kind of valiant superhero task to save all these data sets, right, and websites, but if you talk to one of these librarians, you'll see that it's actually not that action-packed.
The actual, like, saving the data, it's mostly a lot of people sitting at computers. So it's not very glamorous to watch.
I mean, excuse me if I'm kind of like sounding a little old and cynical. I really do say this with love. I'm very tickled that all of these hipsters now think that this is sexy work. But, you know, this is just like kind of a little mundane work sometimes also. It's like writing a lot of citations and footnotes, right?
So that was Margaret Jans, the first person and organizer at the Data Refuge Project, and Debbie Rubina, a professor at Pratt Institute School of Information. And they both helped out this recent end-of-term URL harvesting in 2016. And while they may describe their work as kind of mundane, what they did was really valuable.
All right, so now they're scrambling to archive everything that's been on the web, but can I access all this government data that they've harvested?
Right, that's a great question. So not yet. They are currently working on making all that data accessible to the public. It was a lot of data, after all, like on the petabyte level. So they're working on it.
I'll bet it is. I'd like to bring on another guest now, a digital archaeologist herself who's worked to resurrect old digital relics, video games, virtual worlds, stuff like that for modern eyes. Kara Krauss. Kara Krauss is an associate professor in the College of Information Studies and Department of English at the University of Maryland in College Park. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you. So walk us through this problem of preserving an old artifact of digital culture. In fact, I understand that you saved an old video game called Mystery House. Oh, classic. How'd you do that?
Indeed. Yeah, so this was a game that was first launched in 1980. It was the first work of interactive fiction to include computer graphics. And so this was one of the games in our case set when we were working on the Preserving Virtual Worlds project funded by the Library of Congress. And we basically, in this project, we were interested in investigating different preservation strategies. So Mystery House was a game that we took through the different preservation routes, including hardware preservation, emulation, and migration.
And when you do this, is there sort of an attempt to make the game better? Maybe I can improve it a bit.
I mean, it's interesting that you ask that, Ira, because I would say that something like migration as a preservation practice also veers into creative reimplementation. So if you're trying to update the game, maybe recode it from an obsolete programming language like Fortran into a more modern programming language, you might be tempted to make new changes along the way. It's not unlike adapting, say, a Jane Austen novel for film, for example.
Yeah, very interesting. Lauren, if people want to play some of these old games and use these emulators, where can they do that?
The Internet Archive. The Internet Archive is really great. They have something called an Internet Arcade, among many other types of cool stuff on there. It's this basically a place with a website with 1970s to 1990s video games, so you can go and play Astro Blaster and Mr. Do and Tron. And I geeked out when I saw that you could actually play Oregon Trail on the Internet Archive, which is really great. And those are all emulators, and it's totally public access.
Now, Carrie, I understand that you have also worked to save virtual worlds like Second Life, where we had a lot of real estate.
That's what I've heard, Ira. And yeah, that was the trickiest case study that we had. I would say to a large degree, it was a failure. We ran into a lot of technical and legal problems with Second Life. We took sort of several islands in Second Life. So as you know, Second Life uses the geography metaphors like islands to visualize the world. And so we experimented with Democracy Island, Stanford University Libraries, and a few others. And some of the problems we ran into is, first of all, Second Life gives intellectual property ownership to its creators or its residents, as its players are called. And so we first had to inventory all of the content on an island, then create a donor agreement that we had to track down the residents of Second Life who are active in these islands and see if they'd be willing to sign a donor agreement that would allow us to copy their content and export it out of the world.
My hair is hurting already. Right? It's all that paperwork. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about archiving the internet with Lauren Young and Carrie Krause. And Lauren, the first part of your series deals with a storage medium that is certainly near and dear to my heart, and that is magnetic tape. I understand it's come a long way.
Definitely has come a long way. So actually, a single cartridge of the tapes today can hold hundreds of terabytes of data, and that's equivalent to hundreds of millions of books, really. And actually, this past summer, IBM increased the amount that you can hold on a cartridge to 330 terabytes, which is 330,000 gigabytes per cartridge. It's a lot of data.
So that is the long-term storage of choice. Google still uses it as backup.
Absolutely, yeah. So big companies like Google, particle physics labs like Fermilab, all have these big, massive libraries of tape with thousands and thousands of cartridges there.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kari, what about bit rot? You know, the bits go away on the tape. Is it still an issue with the way we store data today? Or is it an artifact from old-fashioned kinds of tape?
Yeah, I mean, different storage media have different lifespans, right? So in our case, in our project, we worked a lot with magnetic media like floppy disks. And those only have a lifespan of, say, 10 to 14 years. Optical media like DVDs and CD-ROM, I believe, even less. So, yeah, bit rot is going to be a problem across different storage media.
Mm-hmm. And Lauren, you also write about some of the data storage devices of the future. Let's look into our crystal ball.
Right, yeah. Actually, interestingly enough, a lot of the researchers that I spoke to and sources that I spoke to kept referring back to DNA storage, which is something that we've talked about before on the show. But basically, researchers have found a way to store data onto DNA, which is, you know, this billion-year-old molecule that can store the essence of life. So it's pretty incredible that they can do that.
But you can't read it too quickly. It's not an instant storage system.
Right.
Yeah, right?
Absolutely.
So I'm not carrying around a test tube of DNA instead of my thumb drive with me.
Yeah, it's all synthetically made, so it's not genomic DNA or anything like that.
And one last question, Kari. Do you think to some extent this fear of losing all our data is just analogous to, you know, losing documents in fires and things like that? We've always lost data, haven't we?
We have, and I cannot make up my mind whether I think the phrase digital dark ages is overblown or not. Because as you know, Ira, I mean, we have architectural ruins. We have paintings in tatters. So the past always survives in fragments already. And so I don't know. I guess I tend to see preservation as not a binary. Either it's preserved or it's not. There are gradations of preservation. We can often preserve parts of larger wholes. So I see, within the video game community, I see a lot of success in terms of the fan community and game enthusiasts. They're doing a lot of the hard work, and we're sort of riding on their coattails.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you, because, you know, we've all trying to upgrade our digital data so it doesn't get lost. And I wish you good luck, and thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, Kari.
Thanks for having me, and again, congratulations on the project.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Kari Kraus is an associate professor in the College of Information Studies and the Department of English at the University of Maryland in College Park. And thank you, Lauren. It's a great, great website.
Thanks. Yeah, and you guys can all read it at sciencefriday.com/data, which was also the microsite was designed by our great digital producer, Daniel Peterschmidt. So check it out.
There you go. Lauren Young is Science Friday's web producer. And as I say, as she said, you can read all three parts at sciencefriday.com/data.